In the break, I have my reimbursements for the four of you who only four people requested. So whatever, I will. I have the cash to give each of you your reimbursements for royalties. And be sure, when in the future, when you take courses from professors who assign you books, you can say, now how come you're making money off of assigning your books? Isn't that a conflict of interest? Right, you know. Now don't you dare. If you want to cause me trouble.
Eric Gray said that you should give us our money.
If you want to make my life difficult, to retaliate for any of the things that have happened in this course.
That's right, you got to stand up.
Which you disapprove of. That's a surefire way of... It's a surefire way. Okay. Let's return to the history of the future. The classical attempt at the special theory of capitalist history, which I argue is built around five theses. I like to try to formulate theoretical arguments in the form of specifiable propositions. I use the term thesis to elevate them, and these are complex combinations of more specific arguments. I think it's a very useful way of approaching theories, is to try to specify well-articulated propositions. Sometimes that turns out to be extremely difficult. It's one of the things I find very frustrating about Bourdieu, for example. It's very, very hard to turn his arguments into propositions. And that's symptomatic of the fact that a lot of what he's doing is simply mapping out a set of concepts through which one can describe a problem, rather than commit himself to any particular set of claims about how those connect, which would have the form of propositions and which therefore could be unsatisfactory. My dissertation advisor, Art Stinchcomb, who was not a Marxist, said once, one of the nice things about Marxism is that it could be wrong. And I think he was, you know, saying that as a, in praise of Marxism compared to Weber. You know, one of the problems with Weber is that it can't be wrong. The way I similarly like to tweak that point was by saying the problem with Weberians is they can never be surprised by the world. It is a virtue of classical historical materialism, both in its general theory and in the special theory of capitalism, that it could be wrong. And indeed, I think it is in certain important ways. But that's what gives the opportunity to make it better. If it can't be wrong, you can't make it better. If you have this view of the nature of scientific knowledge and the scientific method for advancing knowledge, it's not that you ever arrive at some absolute certainty of the truth, but you have a strategy for figuring out when you got things wrong and improving on it. There's a strategy which we call the scientific method for dealing with anomalies, dealing with the ways in which theoretical arguments turn out to be in contradiction to evidence, and in which you can then reconstruct theory in light of new things that happen in the world, new evidence, new methods, and so on. As a general method of working with theories, then, I do recommend that whenever you're grappling with some body of theoretical ideas, try to turn it into a set of propositions. And when you can't, then try to diagnose what is it about the theoretical argument that makes it intractable or difficult, to distill from it specific propositions. Now, often the way to go about that task is to begin by having really stripped down sort of simple-minded propositions that you know really aren't fully capturing the arguments, and then to add nuance to them. So I argue that the general, that the specific theory of capitalist history, the special theory of the history of the future of capitalism, is organized around five theses, clusters of propositions. The first one is the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism thesis, which is, it's not that it's more important than the others in the sense that one could be wrong, and many elements of the others could still be valid. It's not that everything hinges on each of these, but it's the one which gives the theory its most determinate character. It's the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism thesis is the aspect of the general theory of the specific theory of capitalism that enables Marx and subsequent Marxists to make predictions about the destiny of capitalism. And I would again insist that that was meant to be a very strong prediction. It wasn't just a hunch. It wasn't just a claim that this could happen. It could happen that capitalism will destroy the conditions of its own reproducibility, its own sustainability. It was a prediction that it will, in time, destroy its own conditions of existence. So the destiny of capitalism is its demise. That's far from showing that the future beyond capitalism is human emancipation, socialism, communism, or anything else. It just shows that capitalism itself is not a forever system. It will never reach a permanent reproducible equilibrium. That's a strong prediction. One of the strongest predictions made in social science, I think. And one of the boldest. The grounding of that thesis is basically the theory of the falling rate of profit. Because that's the theory about, that is the theory about how the central mechanism which makes capitalism sustainable gets destroyed over time. Capitalism is a system driven around the accumulation of capital. The accumulation of capital requires profits. If the rate of profit falls, the accumulation of profits, the accumulation of capital becomes more difficult, not impossible, but more difficult. But if there's a long-term continual tendency for it to fall, the system becomes more and more vulnerable to shocks, instabilities. Crises will become more serious over time. They will intensify rather than just be cycles. And all of that creates this increasing vulnerability. Now, one just final note on that first thesis. The first thesis is a prediction about the long-run destination of capitalism. It does not imply that capitalism is overcome only at the point where it no longer could exist. So it's not the claim that the only circumstances in which a revolutionary party, in which class struggles could overcome capitalism, is at the point where it's unsustainable. It's a statement about, in the end, it will be unsustainable, but of course human agency and collective struggle could overcome capitalism well before the point at which it's unsustainable. It becomes weaker, more vulnerable over time. That increases the potential for its transformation. But the first thesis is absolutely silent about the actual timing of the overthrow of capitalism. Right? And that's an important, and not, that's not just a little coda, a little footnote to the first thesis. It's a really important thing to note. Some people have argued against Marxism by saying that Marxism encourages a passivity on the part of popular struggles. People can just sit back and wait for capitalism to destroy itself. You don't have to do anything. It'll destroy itself. It'll end, and then you can build an alternative. That's not in any remote way implied by the first proposition. The first proposition tells popular forces engaged in struggle that eventually you'll win. History is on your side. That's a term, that's an expression that gets used a lot in Marxian informed politics. History is on our side. That gives you courage to struggle because inevitably in the long term the forces of emancipation will triumph. But there's no specification as to exactly what the timing of that triumph will be. And given the stakes involved, the idea that you can hasten the revolution, that's another term, another trope, to use a postmodernist language, another trope that's used in these discourses. You can hasten the revolution by struggling against capitalism well before the apocalyptic demise that would just occur because of its moribund state. That was something that was encouraged by that prediction. There's an irony here, which I think I may have mentioned before. One might think that a deterministic theory with strong predictions leads people to believe that human agency doesn't matter. In fact, I think the actual effect of a strong predictive theory is the opposite. Knowing you're going to win is the best possible medicine for wanting to struggle to win. Believing that there's a pretty good chance that you'll be defeated forever and ever and things will remain the way they are permanently, fearing that that's a possibility, is a is a discouraging fact. The inevitability of victory is one of the things that prompts you to struggle for victory. And indeed, Jerry Cohen has argued that the whole prediction of the inevitability of victory depends upon a belief that if you predict the inevitability of victory, that will indeed encourage people to struggle for victory. The prediction comes from your understanding about how people think and respond and act in the face of their knowledge of possibilities. It's not in spite of that. So the irony is that a very deterministic theory is actually also an agency-centered theory. This goes against the tendency in discussions of social theory to see agency and determinism as kind of opposed to each other. The kind of determinism that Marx is arguing for here depends upon strong views of human agency, that people are conscious, problem-solving, creative actors capable of joining forces to pursue their goals. If that weren't true, Marx couldn't make these predictions. Okay. First thesis, then, is the starting point. In the long run, capitalism is unsustainable. In the course of heading towards that destination, it becomes more and more vulnerable. The second thesis, I call the intensification of anti-capitalist class struggle thesis. The dynamics of capitalist development systematically tend to do two things. First, increase the proportion of the population, the working class, whose interests are pervasively hurt by capitalism. And secondly, to increase the collective capacity of the working class to challenge capitalism. The result is an intensification of class struggle directed against capitalism. So the thesis, the intensification of anti-capitalism, anti-capitalist class struggle, that thesis says that as capitalism develops, there will be a long-term tendency for struggles against capitalism to increase in intensity. This is a parallel trajectory to the trajectory of capitalists of the capitalist system becoming more and more vulnerable to crisis. So you have two long-term trajectories. A trajectory of systemic vulnerability. Capitalism becomes a more fragile social order because of the long-term tendency of the really profit to fall. And class struggles against capitalism tend to increase in intensity over time. The intensification thesis is itself derived from two sub-propositions, the first of which is a kind of almost demographic proposition. It's about a change in the nature of the class structure. Over time, capitalism becomes, as a social order, becomes more polarized between people who are unequivocally opposed to whose interests are unequivocally opposed to capitalism, broadly the working class, who are harmed by the mechanisms of capitalism. And so you have an increase in class polarization. And secondly, that the collective capacity of those people who are harmed by capitalism, their capacity to struggle, increases. Now, these are, again, pretty strong predictions. Marx is not simply arguing that there is an increase in the proportion of the population that are workers, but that increasingly large working class also has an increasing capacity for struggle and resistance. The two things together are what give you the intensification of class struggle. The first alone does not. Unless you believe that struggles are simply driven by interests, which I think any sophisticated pardon my periodic interruptions to clear my breathing passages. You know, any sophisticated theorist of social conflict and social struggle realizes that you cannot derive struggles from interests. There's a tendency, even among sophisticated writers, to periodically write as if specifying the interests in a struggle is sufficient to explain the struggle, that interests drive struggle. The problem is, of course, that people can have interests opposed to a dominant class and have no capacity to organize against the dominant class. And struggle, as an observable conflict of social forces, requires capacities, not just interests. What this second thesis is all about is how there's the simultaneous intensification of interests over the stakes, that is, over the nature of the game being played. There's a simultaneous intensification of those interests and the capacity to struggle for them. The first part of this proposition is often subsumed under the term proletarianization. Proletarianization refers to the process by which class structure is transformed and the working class expands as a proportion of all class locations within the class structure. It's generally thought of as involving two processes. We talked about this to some extent when we had the section on class structure itself. Proletarianization is the result of two sorts of things that happen. One is the destruction of pre-capitalist forms of production. So small farmers, artisans, small shopkeepers, those kinds of social positions are destroyed as capitalist firms take over. So as agribusiness dominates agriculture, small farmers who are not working class are destroyed and become workers. Small shops are destroyed as Walmart takes over the retail business. And small artisanal producers are destroyed as large manufacturing capitalists take over production. So the first aspect of proletarianism is the destruction of non-capitalist forms of production. And the second aspect of proletarianization is often referred to as the degradation of labor within capitalist production itself. So skilled workers have their skills destroyed through the routinization and mechanization of production. Harry Braverman, who was an American Marxist analyst of these problems, is identified as the writer in the last 30 years, sort of the renewed interest in Marxism that began in the 1960s, who wrote most about this. He has a book, Labor and Monopoly Capitalism, which is about the destruction of skills. So the destruction of skills means that those segments of the employee class which had control over their own immediate process of production through their skills become increasingly proletarianized inside of capitalist production. And the first process means that the existence of labor processes outside of capitalism become increasingly destroyed. Those two things taken together give you the increased weight of the working class in the class structure. The class capacity part of the argument comes from the increasing scale of production, increasing urbanization, the reduction of the fragmentation of the working class through increasingly interdependent labor processes. And taking those two things together gives you this increasingly large and cohesive working class, which makes possible the intensification of class struggle. If those trends were to continue, that is, if it were true, that is, if these predictions, the sub-predictions of thesis two, really held, that is, that the working class became increasingly, that the class structure became increasingly proletarianized, and within the capitalist class structure, the labor process became increasingly proletarianized and homogeneous. If that were true, then the slogan, "Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win," you know, the great clarion call of revolutionaries, "Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win," that slogan would have increasingly face validity to workers. They would see that there are fewer and fewer options to being a worker, and being a worker was a more and more homogeneous condition. So people were facing the same constraints, the same dilemmas, the same trade-offs. That's the second thesis. The third thesis is I refer to as the revolutionary transformation thesis. The third thesis states, since capitalism becomes increasingly precarious as an economic system, that's the first thesis, increasing precariousness, while the principal class arrayed against capitalism becomes increasingly large and capable of challenging capitalism, that's the second thesis, because of those two theses, eventually the social forces opposing capitalism will be sufficiently strong and capitalism itself sufficiently weak that the institutions designed to protect capitalism will no longer be able to prevent it from being overthrown. This third thesis, in a sense, is a derivative from the first two propositions, the first two theses. Given the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism, that is, the increasing vulnerability of the system, and given the increasing proletarianization of the class structure and intensification of class struggles, given those two things, eventually the class struggles reach an intensity that intersects a system that's increasingly vulnerable, that those struggles can overthrow the system. Where overthrow the system means the social forces opposing capitalism will be sufficiently strong and capitalism sufficiently weak that the institutions designed to protect capitalism will no longer be able to prevent it from being overthrown. That expression, institutions designed to protect capitalism, that means the superstructures. So the scenario in the revolutionary transformation thesis is that eventually the superstructures will not be able to hold things in place. They will not be able to contain and stabilize the class structure and reproduce its relations, given that the system as a whole is crumbling, it's getting weaker, and that the forces arrayed against it are getting stronger. Capitalism, of course, as we've emphasized, is more than just an economic structure, it also has a superstructure. And in particular, it has a state, and one of the things that the state does is represses class struggles. Thesis 3 would be false if it were the case that superstructures have the kind of autonomy and autonomous basis of power that they could permanently repress class struggles regardless of how intense they were and how vulnerable the system was. So if, so to speak, the superstructures were supported by mechanisms independently, sufficiently independent of capitalism, that they could repress class struggles indefinitely, then this thesis would be wrong. The validity of this thesis depends upon the view that superstructures require a base in order for them to be effective. So that if the base is weakened and becomes crisis-ridden, the superstructures themselves become weak. And the state is particularly important in this respect. So one could imagine, I mean, it would be an alternative theory, that the institutions of the state were so robust and powerful that they could reproduce capitalism even when capitalism became a completely moribund and stagnant system. Even when the rate of profit was close to zero and crises were terrible, the state could retain sufficient cohesion and power to be able to block any challenge against capitalism through sheer repression. One could have, as it were, totalitarian capitalism. That is, a capitalist system which had a massively repressive state that was able to sustain its repressive capacity in spite of permanent stagnation and crisis because of this long-term tendency of the system to become the rate of profit to decline. There are two reasons, I think, that Marxists have felt this was an implausible outcome. Right? So the revolutionary transformation thesis requires that you believe that that is not a very likely thing to happen. And that if it does happen, it's unlikely to be a permanent solution. You know, you could have periods of extremely repressive and authoritarian capitalism under conditions in which capitalism would not otherwise survive. But that cannot be a permanent settlement. There are two kinds of reasons, I think, why Marxists have argued that that possibility, which is logically possible, again, I think this should be treated in a serious way as scientific claims. This is a counter theory, counter thesis. Why would one believe this was unlikely? What are the reasons why a stable equilibrium of permanent repression does not seem as likely as a revolutionary overthrow of a system under those moribund conditions? Well, there's two reasons why I think Marxists have believed this. First, it takes resources to effectively run the state. And the resources come out of the social surplus. So if capitalism is in more or less continual and deepening crisis because of the collapse of the rate of profit, it becomes more and more difficult to fund these social overhead costs. The fiscal crisis of the state is one symptom of this. What that suggests then, what that first argument suggests, is that if capitalism really was in this moribund state, and the state continued to try to repress challenges against it, the state would be forced to transform capitalism in order to get surplus. The state itself would have to violate the principles of the capitalist state. That is, it could not rely on the capitalist character of the state in order to get the resources to do the repression. It couldn't do the repression by taxing the surplus, because there wouldn't be enough surplus to tax. The only way that the state could gain the resources necessary to do its repressive work would be for the state to transform the class structure. Now, that doesn't mean it would be socialist. It could do so by becoming an authoritarian statist structure, where the state directly appropriates surplus through coercion. So that's the first reason why a stable configuration of moribund capitalism and a repressive state is predicted to not be possible. If you got that configuration, the state would just take over capitalism itself and make it and transform it into a different mode of production. In effect, you'd have a revolution from above. The state would be the revolutionary force rather than popular forces. And the second thing is that if capitalism ceased to deliver the goods and was mired in this endless crisis, which is what the first thesis argues, it would become increasingly difficult to maintain the allegiance of the rank and file of the state. So the state internally has a big problem to solve. You've got a state elite, the political directorate of the state, the power wielders, But they themselves don't do a whole lot of repression, after all. You have police, armies, bureaucrats, you have a whole apparatus of the state. How does the state retain the loyalty of its own internal forces? What typically happens when you get these kinds of crisis situations is that the state disintegrates. That you get factions of the state that side with popular forces. That you get civil wars inside of the state. You get defections of forces to opposing sides. That the ability of the state to maintain its internal cohesion becomes very difficult under conditions of prolonged economic crisis. So that's another reason why one would not predict, as a stable solution, a repressive totalitarian capitalism. That combination, moribund capitalism, that is to have a repressive capitalist state with a stagnant and crisis-ridden capitalism will lead either to a disintegration of the state because of the inability to maintain cohesion inside of the state, or the state takeover of the central organs of the economy and therefore a transformation of capitalism from above. Those would be the two predicted outcomes.
Eric, can you say a bit more about that last alternative, because that seems to be the more prevalent one around, right? I know where you see that, when you see coups and
Coups, most coups that we observe in the world do not result in the state taking over the economic structure.
There's a tight link then between, or maybe that's always the case.
Because most empirical cases that we observe don't occur in the specified context of the revolutionary transformation thesis. That is where you have a system crisis. Right? They occur in other kinds of conjunctures in particular places. Yeah.
The crisis you're talking about is a crisis in one nation, or is it a global crisis? Because if it's in one nation surrounded by other nations which are not experiencing the crisis might be very different.
Right, absolutely. The theoretical arguments of the long-term falling rate of profit are system-level arguments about the global system of capitalism. Because of uneven development, it'll occur in different intensities and different paces, and will have different consequences in different places. So the intensity of a system crisis might not be felt as strongly in some places because of their ability to siphon off surplus from parts of the world to other parts of the world, which would create the illusion that the system as a whole wasn't lacking in its ability to extract surplus. This is the five theses of the special theory of capitalism basically assume a global system-level analysis. They're not dealing with the particular uneven developments of particular nation states and what. Thailand.
I think we can also point to examples how these personal of the state siding with the people happens. I mean, for instance, in Russia, half of the army was organized by Bolsheviks, and they were, the army was itself against each other. Or in Tiananmen Square, they knew that the army settled in Beijing wouldn't shoot on the protesters. That's why, because they brought soldiers outside of the Beijing area who don't speak the same dialect with the people. So in order to break the relationship,
sure. And the points you're just making indicate that this general, very abstract thesis, and then the arguments that back it, can be applied to circumstances other than the general system crisis, right? So the argument, the revolutionary transformation thesis says that capitalism becomes increasingly vulnerable as a system, the forces arrayed it become increasingly strong. Eventually, those two tendencies cross, in such a way that the overthrow is possible. And then the two reasons why permanent repression are unlikely are the two reasons I gave. What you've just pointed out is that those two reasons apply in contexts other than the revolutionary transformation thesis. That is, they apply where you have a particular crisis in a particular country. Some of these same arguments would still apply. There's a problem of how you maintain the cohesion of the repressive apparatus. That's a chronic problem in repressive regimes. And sometimes it leads to the disintegration of those regimes. And there's the problem of how the regime gets its resources, which is another problem in repressive regimes. The classical bourgeois revolutions, you know, France being the paradigm case, the French Revolution, was primarily a revolution that occurred because of the fiscal crisis of the state. That is, the state lost the capacity to finance repression, essentially. And the fiscal crisis of the state was so huge in late 18th century France that the state was forced to try to form an accommodation with the rising class forces in order to acquire a surplus for its own state operations. But once it tried to do that, then all hell broke loose. Yeah?
This first point listed as a point of why Marxism kind of that it's an unlikely outcome of superstructure to sustain an economic crisis. Wouldn't it also be the case that if the state took over the means of production to produce the necessary surplus to maintain the repressive apparatuses, that it's not necessarily a transformation of the mode of production, that instead the state is becoming a strictly capitalist element, but the political form has taken the form of a totalitarian or more repressive regime?
So that. It's worth thinking about this point. It's a little bit off of this immediate subject, but I think it's worth talking about. And this is an issue in a slightly different form that will reappear on our weekend retreat. Okay. My first argument, just to relocate this point. The key sentence in the statement of thesis 3 is, the institutions designed to protect capitalism will no longer be able to prevent it from being overthrown. Right? And the first reason why I argue that would be true is that it takes resources for the state to effectively reproduce capitalism. The state needs resources to pay the army. Let's keep it simple. That's the simplest version of this problem. Is the state needs resources to pay the army. In the absence of those resources, then there are really two kinds of possibilities. One is the state becomes very weak and it gets overthrown. The other is that the state overthrows capitalism, revolution from above, in order to be able to directly appropriate surplus rather than relying on taxing surplus that gets generated through capitalist markets. Now, one view is that if the state does that, it actually just creates a new form of capitalism. There's one line of theoretical argument that has been made, which says that an economy in which the state owns the principal means of production and extracts surplus directly is just a special form of capitalism. I don't think that's a plausible theoretical idea. I think that's a new mode of production. It's not socialist and it's not capitalist. It's a distinctive mode of production, what I call a statist mode of production, for want of a better term. The Soviet Union I describe as a statist mode of production, as I would describe China during a certain period of its development, that it was a state-run economy with directly coercive extraction of surplus and authoritative allocation of the surplus to different lines of production through some kind of bureaucratic planning process. And that's not the way capitalism works. That's a different set of property rights, a different set of property relations, different mechanism of exploitation, and a different mechanism of allocation of surplus. So it's, to me, that is no longer a capitalist economy. To describe that as a special form of capitalist economy, to me, means that the word capitalism just means exploitative. Doesn't mean anything else. Doesn't have anything to do with private ownership, with tendencies for rates of profit to equalize across firms and sectors. It doesn't have anything to do with all the things that normally we think define, make capitalism capitalism. Yeah?
Can you sort of explain that again, like in the sense of relating it directly to capitalism? Like, what are exactly the differences? Because, I mean, how does a statist mode of production actually function? I mean, the government owns, the government owns these firms and stuff, but actually people own them. I mean, people don't own them, but they're put in charge of it. And
they don't own, it's crucial that they don't own
it. Right, yeah.
That's the whole...
Right. But I mean, there are people who basically are put in the place of where the capitalists would normally be, and they're extracting surplus labor, not for themselves, but for the state. I mean, so all it is just, instead of going to the capitalist, it's going to something above the capitalist. So.
The state hires managers to run means of production. We distinguish feudalism from capitalism. Feudal lords also hire the sheriff of Nottingham to do, so to speak, to do their managerial work. All class modes of production have ways of delegating authority to lower levels of actors who are involved in controlling particular parts of the system of production. So the question is, what is the nature of the mechanisms by which surplus is extracted and allocated to different purposes? In capitalism, capital is owned by individuals who get a rate of return on their capital by allocating that capital to different lines of production. And they will look for signals from rates of profit in the market and other kinds of signals to decide where they're going to allocate their capital. That's why capital flows from firms of low rates of profit to high rates of profit. And that's why there's pressure on firms that have low rates of profit to innovate in order to retain investment, right? So that's the capitalist mechanism. Private ownership, I think, means private ownership. It means that individuals are motivated to allocate capital in particular ways because they get a return on it. In a statist system, a low rate of profit firm can continue forever. There's no pressure whatsoever to reallocate capital from low rates of profit to high rates of profit. Capital is allocated on the basis of political criteria. It's allocated by bureaucrats who do not get a rate of return. They get salaries as employees of the state, but they don't get a rate of return on allocating their capital to particular sources. They just get a salary. The levels of inequality that get generated in that kind of system are not small, but they are orders of magnitude less than they are in capitalist systems, precisely because individuals cannot individually accumulate capital. Now, I think those are all profound differences. It leads to very different rhythms of development, very different contradictions. The contradictions in the Soviet economy were not the same as the contradictions in the European economies. Very different kinds of contradictions. They had contradictions that are often thought of as the pathologies of central planning. They had contradictions that had to do with how do you in fact allocate capital to a particular sector or particular firms, and how do you hold people accountable for not wasting and squandering that capital, given that you don't have clear profit signals from markets. So I really think these are different kinds of economic mechanisms. Here's a reason why this is not just fiddling around with words and trying to create a vocabulary, why this matters. There's one line of thinking that has had a pretty strong purchase inside of the Marxist tradition, which is that the only alternative to capitalism was some kind of socialism. And therefore, if you overthrew capitalism, you got socialism. There wasn't any other possibility. Right? So there was a kind of logical argument or an attempt to make an argument that was defended just on logical grounds, that capitalism had one alternative. That alternative was socialism. If you had a revolutionary party that seizes power, or if you had a state that seized, had a revolution from above and they destroyed capitalism, then you would get some variety of socialism. I'm clearly arguing against that. I don't think socialism is the only possible future to capitalism. That's the subject of our discussions on the weekend workshop. But it bears on this particular point, that is, if the state were to take over the economy, and the state was organized in an authoritarian and centralized manner, that is creating a different mode of production from capitalism, but not one that is particularly congenial for socialism. Now, it's possible, of course, that such an authoritarian, centralized, statist mode of production could be a transitional form towards socialism. That's what what one might call democratic communists believed. That the sort of authoritarian form that the Soviet Union had was transitional, that the democratization of the Soviet Union would transform it into a socialist society. So democratization became the central task. If you could democratize these authoritarian, centralized forms of planning, the sheer democratization would change the power relations around which the economy was organized and run. And democratization then became the substance of a transition from statism to socialism. I'm using a language that wasn't exactly the language people used, but it's essentially, I think, what the arguments were. Here, though, in the special theory of the future of capitalism, in its kind of strong form, this special theory did not really entertain this possibility. The special theory did not entertain the idea that you could have permanent stagnation of capitalism and the state could then take over capitalism and preempt a revolution by creating something completely different. Some people have claimed that Marx's quip about the alternatives to capitalism being socialism or barbarism contained the idea of that possibility, that the term barbarism would encompass the idea of an authoritarian, non-capitalist, non-socialist social order. That idea is so underdeveloped. I mean, there's just a few passages here and there where the notion of barbarism is posed as the alternative to socialism. It strikes me that, and given what the ordinary meaning of barbarism is, it strikes me that the vision was more just chaos. You know, it would be a kind of social disintegration into a kind of chaotic, barbaric society of warring groups and clans, rather than what came to be the strongly authoritarian statist regimes of the mid-20th century. Okay, well, let's continue with this classic theory. Are there other questions on these particular points? Yeah.
I just wanted to jump back to thesis 1 and 2 really quick. Maybe I'm understanding this incorrectly as oppositional forces, but I'm kind of wondering how you get a simultaneous expansion of the working class, but at the same time a reduction in live labor in the production process, because that seems to be, I mean, I'm kind of understanding the reduction of live labor as less necessity for workers. Is that incorrect? Or
right. So what is likely to be the practical implications of that is that you get an expansion of the proletarianized part of the population, but also increasing unemployment.
So this is an argument for the expansion of the underclass kind of thing. Is that not right?
Well, the term underclass means permanently unemployed that never work, as opposed to precarious population that goes in and out of employment.
Okay.
It's a good point, though. There may be indeed a kind of contradiction in the argument. That is, if the declining rate of profit and rising organic composition of capital occurs at a pace in which an increasing proportion of the population is completely marginalized from capitalism, you know, it becomes really an underclass, that's not a population that is very effective in class struggles. Marx's view was not that it was the desperately poor who would be the vanguard, would be the mobilized forces to struggle against capitalism. It was industrial workers at the heart of the capitalist machine that would have the capacity to struggle, because while the interests in transformation would be even stronger for the underclass, the marginalized population, their capacity for struggle is weak. Whereas the working class in industrial production has much higher capacity for struggle because of their centrality to the system of production. So if it were the case that technological change was marginalizing a vast part of the population, Marx used the term lumpenproletariat to describe that marginalized category. That marginalization would actually undermine class struggle, not intensify class struggle. Or at least it would make class struggles much more problematic. Because of the difficulty of forming solidaristic, stable collective actions that would encompass both the marginalized population and the working class. In this, at the level of abstraction of this general statement of the special theory of future capitalism, the increased unemployment is usually treated not as complete marginalization, but the term that's used is the reserve army of the unemployed. That is, that's unemployment that's closely connected to the labor force, as opposed to unemployment that's marginalized from the labor force.
So it's not stating an absolute increase in unemployment, as I understand it.
Well, the question is whether the rising organic composition of capital
means rising organic composition of capital doesn't mean increasing the reserve army of labor in absolute terms.
If the amount of living labor that's new labor that's being added relative to old labor that's embodied in the machines, the value of old labor embodied in the machines, is constantly declining, it's hard to see how if those magnitudes get such that there's a... I know it's a proportion, but all of that labor that's embodied in those machines was labor performed in the past, not being performed now. And it's hard, if there was just as much labor being performed now, then it's hard to see how the ratios could be that disproportionate. There's in order to get the degree of disproportion that would give you a rate of profit that's tending to zero, that huge store of value that's in the already existing machinery, the machines, another way of thinking about it, the machines would have to have such durability, right? You know, they last a long time as well. I don't know, I'm not being entirely clear. It's not, if you really worked out the math on this, it's not clear what story you would be able to tell that wouldn't also have the effect of producing unemployment. I agree that it doesn't have to on the face of it, but it might under reasonable assumptions about the nature of that store of value. Yes, and
the only thought that I had on that is that if you didn't have an increase in unemployment, what you would get was massive overproduction, which capitalists would tend to, I think, resist simply because it means that they have all of this surplus that they can't sell. You know?
Well, but the overproduction, remember, the key idea, overproduction, underproduction, these are the cyclical sources of crises.
Yeah.
They only get intensified because they're operating against the background of a lower average long-term rate of profit. Right? So it's the mechanism for creating vulnerability in the system still needs to be the declining long-term rate of profit. And then the question that's just been raised, which I don't think we need to pursue further here, is whether or not that long-term decline in the rate of profit, if you understand profit in value terms, labor theory in value terms, wouldn't also mean increasing marginalization of a part of the population. That is, that you'd actually have a declining labor force, not just a declining rate of profit.
If we think about falling rate of profit with all ideas about reserve army of unemployed and overproduction, underconsumption, along with the fettering issue, while the force of productions are developing and social productive relations are not able to carry them, so a system change will occur. I'm having some trouble to bring these two lines of arguments together. We're talking about theoretically as about a decay of capitalism rather than a development, right? So how come the productive forces develop and the patterning of social productive relations occur and they lead to a transition?
Okay, so the fettering argument, of the argument that the relations of production, the existing structure of property rights and economic structure, block the forces of production. That argument, in its capitalist form, I think, has two interpretations. It's two ways you can think about it. The simplest way is this, that as the rate of profit declines and as economic crises become more frequent and more intense and more disruptive, the ability for innovation in capitalism declines. So capitalism has produced this vast amount of knowledge and competence, human competence, to solve problems and create new technologies, but our ability to act on that knowledge and make new innovations is constantly disrupted by the destruction of productive capacity through constant crisis. So crisis would be the economic crisis mechanism of the declining rate of profit, which makes all these other things worse, blocks the further development of the forces of production. That's one form of the argument. Since the development of the forces of production in capitalism comes out of investment from the surplus, but if the time horizons of capitalist production get completely scrambled and if uncertainty increases and if firms are constantly going bust because of all of this chaos, that will be a fettering of the forces of production. The second argument is the one that Cohen makes about use fettering. That the key idea there is that there is an alternative way of organizing production given the level of knowledge and technical capacity we have, which would suddenly make all these forces of production usable for human welfare in a way they weren't before. So that what you're really unfettering by transforming capitalism is the use of the forces of production, not their sheer development. Right? I think both of those arguments come into play and have a particular bite with this crisis intensification due to the falling rate of profit. So crisis intensification will work on both of those. Crisis intensification makes the use of the forces of production less and less effective, and their development less and less systematic. So, thesis, the way to think about thesis three is we have two time trajectories. So this is time, and here's the rate of profit. That's on this scale, and on this scale we have the strength of anti-capitalist
struggle, okay? And the two trajectories are that the rate of profit has this long run tendency to decline with ups and downs around it, and the capacity for struggle has a long run tendency to rise. These metrics, of course, don't mean anything. They're a completely different metric on either side. So the point of crossing isn't the you could design this metric so that you could say the point at which this line crosses this line is the point at which the strength of the opposition against capitalism is greater than the sustainability mechanisms of capitalism, measured by the rate of profit. I don't mean this to be taken literally. In any case, at some point, this will be sufficiently high and this sufficiently low that the system can be transformed. Jan Elster, in his discussion of these problems, argues that actually the capacity to struggle against capitalism, the curve, doesn't look like that. The curve looks like this. And that the maximum strength of the ability to struggle against capitalism occurs before the rate of profit has declined to the point that capitalism is vulnerable.
And is there a result of it?
No, it's that that this is the result of the particular way that the technological changes of capitalism have disorganized the mass of the population and created a large middle class, essentially. So if you think of the development of capitalism does a variety of things. It may lower the long-term rate of profit. It initially increases the size of the working class, but then it fragments the working class and expands contradictory locations such that the capacity for struggle against capitalism begins to decline. Well, when we critique these theses, well, that's one of the arguments, yeah.
So that the first part of is it historically true that the capacity to struggle, you know, increases? So it seems to me when capitalism develops in a country like the United States, as blue collar work decreases, white collar work increases in a way that doesn't really develop that capacity to struggle, to really strongly struggle, and then that blue collar work goes to other parts of a nation.
Right, so that's one of the criticisms of the classical model. Yeah. In the classical model, it was not envisioned that the rate of growth of white collar work would be so much faster than the rate of growth of blue collar work, and that they would be spatially dislocated in the way they were. That was not envisioned. Marx did at various times envision the growth of a middle class, but it was always a secondary tendency, much weaker than the growth of the working class. He never imagined that it could grow in ways that would undermine the solidaristic potential of class struggles. But that's one of the points of criticism that we'll come to in a moment. All right, so we have thesis three. Thesis four, yeah.
Question about the defining rate of profit. Can we calculate the point in which the rate of profit would be that low that it wouldn't allow the system to reproduce itself? Basically, because we can probably empirically look at a tendency of the falling rate of profit, but is that a point in which the system is just not reproducible?
I think the real thrust of the falling rate of profit theory is that crises become more intense over time. That's what it really predicts, is the system is more and more fragile, and that the amplitudes of crises are greater, the troughs are deeper, the peaks are not as high, and they're closer together. And it has at least the image of their entering a state of kind of permanent crisis, with just ebbs and flows of how bad things are, as opposed to and that that occurs because the rate of profit has continues to decline. Now, whether
is there a threshold?
I don't know. I don't think there's likely to. I don't think the theory has the kind of clarity to define exactly what that threshold would be. Part of the problem, of course, is that there may be other forces that are affecting the magnitudes of the regular business cycles around this long-term trend. If you had the magnitude of the business cycles becoming smaller and smaller around a declining trend, that wouldn't make the system might not become more unstable then. You know, so that if you know if you have cycles that are like this, and they get smaller and smaller because of things directly operating on the cycles, like Keynesian policies, then even though the trend is going down, the system might not become more unstable. okay, let me. What I'd like to do is let me finish the going through the theses. Then we'll take a break, and then we'll criticize the theses. We've been introducing some criticisms as we go along, but we'll more systematically go through the criticisms. Thesis 4 is the transition to socialism thesis. Remember, thesis 3 just postulates the overthrow of capitalism eventually. What thesis 3 says is, because the system gets more and more vulnerable, because the struggles against become more intense, eventually capitalism is overthrown. And that the superstructures cannot permanently block that for the two reasons that I suggested. Thesis 4 says, given the ultimate non-sustainability, thesis 1, and the interests and capacities of social actors arrayed against capitalism, thesis 2, in the aftermath of the destruction of capitalism, thesis 3, socialism, defined as a society in which the system of production is collectively owned and controlled through egalitarian democratic institutions, is the most likely successor, since the collectively organized working class will be in the best position to ensure that its interests are embodied in the new post-capitalist institutions. Thesis 4, I think, is a claim that given that the social actors who will actually do the overthrowing are rooted in the working class, because that is the class with the capacity for that kind of struggle. The class that has the capacity for struggle is the working class, not other segments or fractions of classes. And given that its interests would be in the overthrow, not just the overthrow of capitalism, but the construction of a new form of production that would serve the interests of direct producers, that is, of workers, given that those claims, then socialism is the most likely outcome. There are, I think, three reasons for this optimism. First, capitalism raises the level of productivity enormously, which means that in a post-capitalist society, scarcity in the broad sense is largely overcome. This makes more egalitarian distributions easier to sustain. But also, and this is a point that isn't, I think, explicitly stated by Marx, but it's implicit in some of his reflections on these issues, high productivity liberates time for people to engage in the collective responsibilities for democratically running an economy. To democratically organize a complicated thing like an economy takes a lot of time. A high productivity economy is one in which the amount of time needed to do that is possible. So high productivity is one of the reasons for the optimism, that in the aftermath of overthrowing capitalism, it's socialism that gets created, not something else. A second reason for the optimism is that capitalist development already generates giant megacorporations, which are kind of sort of quasi-social property. That is, it's not individual owners running individual companies anymore. These are gigantic corporations in which it's stock owners who own the companies, but they largely have almost nothing to do with the running of the company. You know, they just buy and sell stocks. They may elect boards of directors, but as we know, boards of directors have a pretty feeble relationship to the actual running of corporations. Now, that may be bad for capitalism in the sense that it leads to corporations acting in all sorts of inefficient ways from a capitalist point of view, but it creates some of the conditions for socialism. If the stocks, so to speak, are owned by the people and they hire the managers, and then you create internal democratic governance within corporations, well, that seems pretty much along the way towards something you might call socialism. The large corporate form Marx regarded as a partial socialization of property inside of capitalism. There's at least some places where he suggests that corporations are somehow less fully capitalist than the privately owned firms that they replaced, precisely because of the separation of ownership and control. And finally, the other reason for the optimism was, in order for the working class to overthrow capitalism in the first place, it has to develop a very high level of class consciousness and collective organization. So it will have, in a sense, accomplished some of what it needs to accomplish to build an alternative in its efforts to overthrow the old order. And given that it had that kind of power as a political force, this would put it in a position to construct the kind of new egalitarian and democratic institutions that would embody those interests. Those were the reasons for optimism, but in the end, I think, Marx's theory of why we should expect socialism to be the outcome if you overthrow capitalism, it's pretty much a theory that could be summarized by the folks saying, where there's a will, there's a way. And necessity is the mother of invention. So we have these two folk expressions in English. I'm sure there's Spanish equivalents to all of these. You know, where there's a will, there's a way. That means if you have enough determination, you can accomplish whatever you want. Where there's a will, you'll find the means to do it. And necessity is the mother of invention means where there's huge problems to be solved, that's the necessity. That spurs you to experiment and to invent things. I think that Marx's basic view about the construction of socialism was that it would occur through a process of democratic experimentation by organized and powerful working class social and political forces. They would have the power to engage in those experiments and the will to engage in them and the power to block counter-revolutionary attacks on those experiments. So that's a pretty complicated set of expectations. But that's about as much of a theory of why socialism should be the outcome of the overthrow of capitalism that Marx proposed. I don't think the special theory of capitalism has a stronger theory than that, of why we should expect socialism. One might argue, indeed, that it's wishful thinking, you know, that this was just optimism on Marx's part, but not an actual theory of the transition to socialism. But it doesn't strike me as such a bad theory. If the first three propositions were correct, as if everything up to this point was right, then the idea that in the aftermath of overthrowing capitalism, there would be the social space to build an alternative that would be directed by the democratic organized political forces that overthrew capitalism, isn't implausible. This more voluntaristic theory of building socialism strikes me as reasonably plausible given the previous three general theses. Finally, thesis five, which I think one might call the utopian thesis of the special theory, could be called the communism destination thesis, which is an argument about where the future development of socialism would go. So socialism is a democratically egalitarian society where the economy is run through various kinds of democratic egalitarian institutions, but in which there still is a state and there still are various forms of inequalities that exist. And some of those inequalities at least have a class-like character to them. The communism destination thesis states the dynamics of socialist development gradually leads to a strengthening of community solidarity and a progressive erosion of material inequality so that eventually classes and the state wither away, resulting in the emergence of a communist society organized by the distributional principle, to each according to need, from each according to ability. That's the kind of utopian destination that Marx saw as the destiny of socialism, given that socialism is the form of society and economy in the aftermath of the overthrow of capitalism. So the overall logic then of these five theses are, you have a thesis about the non-sustainability of capitalism, a thesis about the agents capable of overthrowing capitalism, a claim that eventually the power of agency becomes sufficiently large and the weak and the robustness of the existing system is sufficiently precarious that agency can transform capitalism, and a thesis that the kind of transformation that will occur will be a democratic egalitarian one, given the nature of the forces arrayed against capitalism. And then a final thesis, that a democratic egalitarian alternative to capitalism will eventually develop into communism. And thus, you have a theory of the future, of capitalism's future and destination. Taken together, that's a pretty extraordinary theoretical structure. There are various alternative formulations of each of these, but I think this accurately tracks the main contours of the special theory of capitalism's features. Let's take a break, and then we can discuss problems, unfortunately, with each of these propositions.